The next Cascadia subduction zone earthquake, it's been 315 years now, will likely trigger a tsunami that will inundate parts of the Pacific coast from California north to British Columbia. The effects would differ from place to place based on a number of factors, and one of those is readiness. A recent report took a look at tsunami readiness up and down the coast and found that tens of thousands of people living in coastal areas might not have the time to evacuate. The report has a mouthful of a title, Community Clusters of Tsunami Vulnerability in the U.S. Pacific Northwest. It was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, PNAS. Nathan Wood is a research geologist at the U.S. Geological Survey in Portland and the lead author of the study and our guest on The Exchange. Nate, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So this is one of your areas of expertise, I gather, looking at natural hazards and the ability of people to escape them.
That's right. I've been doing this. I'm actually a geographer. I started out as a geologist for my undergrad and master's, and then I tell people I saw the light, and it's now in geography because it helps people actually get actionable information to do something about these hazards. We can't really stop the tsunami from happening, but we sure could do a lot to get out of harm's way.
Have the tools to perform the kind of analysis you do improved in recent years?
They have. I'm lucky in terms of career that right around when people started talking more about the vulnerability of communities and not just the physical hazard of it, has also been around the same time in the rise of what's called geographic information systems, GIS.
GIS. Mm-hmm.
And it's basically Google Maps on steroids. So instead of trying to find where the local restaurant is at night or how to get home with traffic, I'm integrating demographic data, business data with hazards, and then modeling things to figure out how long it might take you to get out of harm's way.
How extensive is the demographic data? I mean, you probably have things like age on there, which would account for some of the discussions we've already heard about. Some people would take a little longer to get out of the way of a tsunami.
Exactly, yeah. The data we're using on the people is the U.S. Census Bureau's population counts that they do every 10 years. We actually have locations. They're called blocks, which are in urban areas. They are kind of around the same size as a neighborhood block, but as you get in more rural areas, they get a lot bigger. But attached to that, at the smallest level, we'll get the number of people, but then we'll also get age. So what we typically bring out of that data is folks under 5 and folks over 65, race, ethnicity, single mother households, renters, folks living in adult residential care or some kind of institution. So we can learn a lot from demographics. And that actually is the whole thrust of vulnerability research is I'm trying to look at what's going on in the community before the event that might influence your ability to prepare, respond, and recover from these catastrophic physical events.
So it sounds like you're really looking for kind of a cross-referencing of things that would figure with geography, topography, low-lying areas, that sort of thing, and then cross-reference that with the kinds of people who live there.
Exactly, and the modeling we're doing for evacuations takes into account the land cover. So are you trying to cross a paved parking lot or grass or shrubs or trying to push through bushes or on the beach? Then we also take into account the elevation because it's a lot easier walking along a flat road than it is walking uphill. So the land cover and the elevation are kind of the two main things we throw into the model. And then a lot of things happen within the software and it kicks out how long it might take you to get from that spot, just assuming everyone's the same, and then we try to throw on top of that, well, what happens if you're, let's say, 75 years old or a renter or a single mom? What are the things that might influence not just physically but because of your ability to prepare and things like that? So we try to – it brings in a lot doing these geographic studies of the physical landscape, the social demographics, distance issues, and then you throw on top of that an actual wave coming in at a certain speed and trying to figure out will people get out. And then that leads to, well, if we know that, what can we do about it? Are there places where education would be good or evacuation training? And in some rare places on the coast here in the Northwest, do they need to talk about possibly vertical evacuation shelters?
You know, that was the term that really stood out to me, and I don't know that I'd know the term. What is a vertical evacuation shelter?
Yeah, it's one of the terms that if you're in this field, you kind of think it's common sense. And but then even I talk to family and friends, and they're like, that doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. And then the basic concept is humans building something to provide high ground. So we always hope that people can get out to natural high ground if they have the ability and the time. If they don't, then possibly we build. There's different examples throughout the world, but it could be a elevated parking garage. It could be a tower that they have a few of these in Japan. It could be what they actually call, they call berms, which are just big hills. Imagine like a football field, but about 50 feet in the air. And actually, they just broke ground in Southwest Washington, where they're adding an engineered roof to the elementary school on top of the gymnasium in Ocosta Elementary School near Westport, where folks can, the kids and anyone who lives nearby, can run up to the roof of the elementary school to avoid the waves coming in.
All right, so it doesn't have to be, the structure certainly has to be robust enough to withstand the tsunami itself, but the big point is just to get the people above the water.
Exactly, and actually it has to withstand not only the impact forces of the wave, but that tricky little magnitude 9 earthquake happening before. So there's significant ground shaking. I mean, 4 to 5 minutes is what the geologists say. The whole northwest coast will drop a little bit from, it's called subsidence, because of the way the tectonic plates are interacting. You see a ground shaking, liquefaction of the soils, and then 10 minutes later, or in some areas, you've got this large wave coming in, which it won't just be one wave. It'll probably be a wave every couple of hours for the next probably 24 hours. So it really is this kind of suite of hazards that people living on the coast will have to contend with.
Nathan Woods, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, research geographer at U.S. Geological Survey in Portland and the lead author of that recent study referenced a lot in the news called Community Clusters of Tsunami Vulnerability in the U.S. Pacific Northwest. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 around the listening area, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Was it pretty much all the U.S. parts of the Cascadia subduction zone that you looked at?
It was, exactly, yeah. And the zone actually extends into British Columbia. It goes, if people know the town of Tofino up on the west side of Vancouver Island, it extends all the way up to there. For this research, we focused just on the American side of the issue, but for us that includes on the south end, Humboldt County and Eureka, all the way up to the Canadian border. On the very top, we have Bellingham and Whatcom County. So it's about, a good 600 miles south to north. In our study, we identified 73 different jurisdictions, which are a mix of incorporated cities, tribal reservations, and then 17 counties, because there is a lot of unincorporated land that people may not have their own mayor or police force, and they might have a harder time reacting and responding to this thing.
Were you able to come up with any sort of shorthand for the communities to understand how what their current readiness status might be for a tsunami? I mean, do you have anything that's quite that easy, like we're a red community, we're a green community, whatever?
Well, we kind of, yeah, it's hard getting into, like when you do evacuation modeling, it's hard, and you can say it, but I always have a heartburn when I say it, of these folks definitely won't make it, and these folks are definitely safe. Because if I say they're definitely not going to make it, then people kind of give up hope. If you tell them they're totally going to make it, then they may not prepare as well because they say, well, Nate said we're ready to do anything. And the reality is everyone who lives and works and plays in a tsunami hazard zone has to know that, and has to know that they're really on their own, that while you're running to high ground, so will the county sheriff. And so people have to take self-responsibility for this. And the takeaway that when we did this analysis, one of the things we wanted to do was also kind of create, in effect, sister cities to say you're not alone. There's many communities that have this risk from evacuation from a tsunami, and there's some similarities. So look not just to your neighbors but other parts of the Cascadia stretch to figure out, do you have some brethren? Can you leverage limited money? And so at the end of the day, what we did with our evacuation modeling, we then threw it into a statistical analysis to do things called clusters, and that's the clunky part of our article title. But the goal was to say, okay, we have 73 towns, but really there's only three types of towns. There's one group, which is a lot of the communities, which we called Group 1, that don't have as many people and employees and public venues and retail, all that sort of stuff. They don't have many, and high ground's pretty close. So that's good. As long as people know about that and are educated on the threat and maybe practice to go to the hills every now and then. There's the second group, which down in your part of the coastline would include Eureka and Crescent City.
Mm-hmm.
We call the Group 2s. So they have a lot of people living and working in the hazard zone. But high ground's pretty close, and most will make it, and the majority will, especially if they get going a little faster. High ground is really close, and if they just get to a fast walk or even can maintain a slow run, hopefully, knock on wood, there aren't many deaths, if at all. So these groups, this group of communities, we would say education is always critical, but they might want to invest in evacuation training. So get people out, like with public health campaigns, to walk. But when they're out walking, they walk the evacuation route. And so they realize that not only will walking every day make you healthier, make you help live longer, hopefully, but it might also save your life during a tsunami. The third group are the ones that some people already knew about, but it was the group of the communities that really high ground is just way too far in the 15 to 20 minutes they may have. And that's mostly in the southwest of Washington and Seaside, Oregon, but Long Beach, Washington, Ocean Shore, Seaside, and then two county lands, Grace Harbor and Pacific, where high ground is really far. They don't have as many people as the group twos, but they really need to be talking about vertical evacuation if they're going to save lives. Education is always good, especially for those distant events like another Japan earthquake that sends a tsunami our way, or an Aleutian, Alaskan earthquake. But for the Cascadia threat, the one that shows up in 15 minutes, education may not be enough for those group three. So we try to break it down of, you know, gigs of data to get to the point of who needs education, who needs evacuation training, and who may need vertical evacuation shelters.
Okay, so a lot of it is based on the topography more than the demography?
Exactly. Yeah, a lot of this was focusing on the numbers of people in the zone. That's all based on the demographic data. But when we start bringing in the evacuation modeling, that is related more to the geography of the land cover, the landscape, or the elevation and land cover. We do bring, though, in that group one community, set of communities, there are some subgroups, and that got into more demographic issues, saying, well, you're all kind of similar in terms of not many people and high ground is nearby, but group 1A, you have a higher percentage than others of Hispanic or Latino. So that might suggest, well, maybe making sure that materials are in Spanish. Another group has higher than normal folks over 65 years in age. And that might be some retiree communities where even getting two blocks might be difficult because of mobility issues. And after the event, Red Cross and others might want to realize, you know, this is not a typical clientele. You may need to have more medical relief aid for folks who already have pre-existing conditions. And then the third group in that group one are the tribes that exist up in the Northwest. So demographically, it made sense. We saw higher than normal American Indian or Pacific Islander, but also because of just cultural societal issues, there was a lot of single mother households in these communities. So trying to help them prepare when they already have so many pre-existing concerns might help them save their lives and their families from a tsunami.
Nathan Wood, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, research geographer with U.S. Geological Survey in Portland, the lead author of the study, Community Clusters of Tsunami Vulnerability in the U.S. Pacific Northwest. You had made a reference to this quite a while back about making sure that structures survive earthquakes, and I wonder what kinds of assumptions you made in this study about the intactness of roads and things that people would need to evacuate in advance of the tsunami.
That's a great point. Yeah, so sometimes people say, oh, why can't they just get in their cars? I'm like, well, you've got thousands of people that would not be in their cars, hands on the keys. They're probably in their house somewhere at work. So the time it would take to get out of your car, you might burn up 5 of your 15 minutes, which probably wouldn't be the best call if it was me. The other part is there is going to be a magnitude 8 or 9 earthquake that sets off these tsunamis. And so 4 minutes of shaking, you're probably going to have power lines dropping at random places along the road. And then you have a thing called liquefaction, where when you shake sand, it kind of becomes jelly, and it'll shoot up through cracks in the road and create these big piles of sand. And so you or I trying to walk or run can kind of go around it. But when you're in a car, there's a lot of examples. I know I've seen some great shots of the New Zealand earthquake where, you know, pickup trucks are sitting basically in these big sinkholes, and the chance of you getting out your car is pretty low. I mean, there's always occasions where someone said, like in the 2010 Chile event, one guy drove out, and that is possible. But for a whole community, it's much more likely that people will have to walk and or run up to high ground. And that was partly the reason we did the research, is that we wanted to show that there are a lot of communities where you don't have to get in your car, that people can hopefully walk to high ground, which will lead to not having congestion and people getting stuck in their cars as the waves come in. So we wanted to raise what psychologists call positive outcome expectancy, give them a potential behavior change, and demonstrate that it can save your life more so than kind of guessing and jumping in your car, where there's a lot more things that could go wrong.
Are there any policies, prescriptions suggested? You did mention the ideas of vertical evacuation structures or refuges, but I mean other things like maybe broadening escape routes so there's more room for more people or something?
Yep, that is one. Broadening the routes, making sure the routes are always there for you, and that can mean one of two things. One is you could have a pathway that goes over a bridge or maybe a diked embankment that could liquefy during an earthquake. So it's trying to figure out where are the people, how are they getting to high ground, and if it's place going across a place that might fail, a community might want to make sure that key congestion or choke point doesn't fail. The other one is a lot simpler, where if you've got people running maybe across a field or up a hill, well, if that field is covered in blackberries for 4 months of the year during the summer, no one's going to get to high ground. So we often talk about not these grandiose engineering plans, but just paying some local kid to go mow the lawn might save a lot of people's lives. So trying to find the low-cost solutions all the way up to these big engineered structures. And the main point of this article is that every community is different and not the same intervention will work everywhere. So the mowing of lawns, the building of shelters, even just doing more targeted education, understanding you've got folks that might have greater mobility issues and maybe partnering them with a local neighborhood to help folks get to higher ground. We did work, 10 years ago in Newport, Oregon, and there's an assisted living facility only probably 3 or 4 blocks from high ground, and you and I could make that easily in 15 minutes, but the folks who are at this home couldn't. So there was talk of neighbors running in and helping someone in a wheelchair and pushing them up to high ground. So it's that kind of stuff that might help a lot, save lives.
I know you're getting calls from lots of reporters. You're getting calls from lots of governments, too, wondering what they can do to implement these ideas?
I have, yeah. We've been briefing higher-ups in terms of state and federal, and we've actually been teaching other countries as well to do similar stuff because local tsunamis isn't just the U.S. problem.
Not at all, no. In fact, the report is called Community Clusters of Tsunami Vulnerability in the U.S. Pacific Northwest. Nathan Wood, research geographer with the U.S. Geological Survey, is the lead author, and he's been our guest. Nathan, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, take care.